From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a new play about Anne Frank is getting excellent reviews. You'll meet the playwright. It's her first produced piece and the director who commissioned it. Extraordinary Things is playing at Sacramento's B Street Theatre. Also, how to be more adventurous with your food and, in turn, more connected to it. You'll meet food writer Hank Shaw with his new book, Hunt, Gather, Cook. And the 38th annual Sacramento Jazz Festival starts in a couple of hours. What's new this year? First, one of the problems with our healthcare system is that many people with so-called pre-existing conditions do not have insurance. Either they're turned down because insurers don't want the risk, or they're offered a plan but they can't afford it. The federal healthcare overhaul fixed this, but most people don't know about it. Joining us to talk about the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan, or PCIP, is the top Medicare official for California and several other Western states. He's David Sein, and he is regional administrator of the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Region 9 in San Francisco. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, what are pre-existing conditions? Could you give us some examples, please?
Well, it's interesting. Lots of people, it's a big word, and we're having conversations about trying to find a better word to use. It can be something very simple. I mean, I have a friend that's walking around with a gallstone that's been in her body for years, but when she went to try to get insurance, she was denied. I have another friend that a doctor told him he should drink less because he was having trouble sleeping. And when he told an insurance company that he had seen this doctor, they turned him down because they figured maybe he's an alcoholic or something like that. On the other hand, it could be cancer. It could be leukemia. So any medical condition an insurer could deny you for.
But the insurance exists to help cover costs of expenses. Surely there's some kind of premium that could work to cover even someone with an expensive condition.
Well, there are some conditions that people, that insurance companies would prefer not to deal with. So for the two friends that I mentioned, they could get insurance, but it was very expensive. But if you're walking around with something like leukemia, it would be a little bit like buying insurance for your house if it was already on fire.
So in many cases, these people are just flat out denied insurance, or in some cases, I guess, they are offered insurance, but it's more expensive than most people could afford.
And that's where the health reform comes in, and the what's envisioned in the law really solves this problem in 2014, when insurers will no longer be allowed to deny people insurance or price insurance on the basis of an individual's health. And what we're talking about today is a stopgap program that was put in place and required to be stood up 90 days after the law was passed so we could help people right away that were in this situation.
So starting in 2014, insurers will not be able to deny people because of these pre-existing conditions. But right now, there's a stopgap plan. How does it work?
Well, it's a federally funded plan. $5 billion was set aside for this plan. And the California plan is actually administered by the state with a subsidy from the federal government. It has a website, pcip.ca.gov. PCIP is the initials that we're using for that long name. And basically, there's a simple schedule of premiums. We think that they're fairly reasonable, and it's available to anyone who has been denied or presented with unaffordable insurance, that being more expensive than this program, and who've been without coverage for 6 months.
Are there any people who are excluded from even PCIP? In other words, are there any pre-existing conditions or conditions of some kind that even PCIP says, no, we cannot cover you because of that?
Not medical conditions, no. The program is limited, though, to a legal residence of the United States or U.S. citizens.
We're talking about PCIP, which is the acronym for the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan. It's a stopgap measure under the federal healthcare overhaul, more properly known as the Affordable Care Act. My guest is David Sein, who is the regional administrator for Medicare in California and several other Western states known as Region 9. You said that the California plan, but this is a result of the federal healthcare overhaul. Why is it being run at the state level and not by the federal government?
Well, at the time the law was passed, a number of states, including California, already had their own high-risk programs of varying kinds, and some states didn't. And so to be able to stand the program up faster, the law asked the states to use the federal subsidy and run these programs because they already know how to do it. But about half the states elected not to do that, and we have a federal program that covers those other states.
How does this work? Are the private insurance companies part of the plan, and the feds are now giving people enough money to reassure the insurance companies that they won't be on the hook for some extraordinary expense? Or is the Medicare program basically now the insurer for these people?
Okay. Well, there's a couple questions in there, but the simplest way to describe it in this case is the state, through the medical or the Managed Risk Medical Insurance Board, has engaged a single insurer to operate a program for them that is this pre-existing insurance program. So there's just this one program. It has a robust network of physicians. It's kind of the traditional coverage. It does have a deductible. There is some coinsurance. Perhaps, you know, the most important thing about this plan is there's an out-of-pocket maximum of $2,500. So that means you pay the premium, and if your deductibles and coinsurance exceed that $2,500 out-of-pocket, after that you don't pay anything. So that's what's huge about this. It's catastrophic coverage for people who are really sick. And so it's just a single plan. And in those states that are using the federal plan, we, the federal government, have a single insurer, GHAA, running that program for us.
The out-of-pocket maximum, you said, is $2,500.
That's correct.
But if someone has a pre-existing condition that is an expensive condition, doesn't this run the risk of being extremely expensive for the federal government to run? Because if someone incurs medical bills of, say, $50,000, then that's a lot of money that the feds are having to put into the plan.
Well, that's why we have actuaries, and the actuaries determine that $5 billion would be sufficient for the number of people that would show up for this program through January of 2014. Interestingly, right when the law was passed, everyone walked around saying, oh my goodness, you're going to blow through $5 billion in the first 2 months, 3 months, and that's not the case at all. Actually, we want to burn through that money, and that's why we're talking today, and that's why I'm talking to anyone that will sit still and listen to it to say, hey, you may know somebody who's in this position, and they don't know that they can now have insurance, and they've been walking around scared.
Well, an out-of-pocket maximum is one thing, but there's the monthly expense of the premium. How's that calculated?
Well, I think it's pretty reasonable. And for our friends in California, the state is divided into six regions. In Nevada, I think there's a single premium for the state. I know we have some listeners from Nevada today. But to give an example of this, if we look at the Sacramento area, which is, So in Region 2, you know, for a kid, somebody 18, it's $138 a month. If we get to an older guy like me who's, you know, post 55, it's a little over $600. Now, that's not inexpensive, but the reality is, you know, a guy my age, you're past 55, there's some risk there. And if I presented to another insurer and I was walking around with cancer or something, they wouldn't even give me insurance, and I'd be, you know, happy to pay this. So it's not free, but it's heavily subsidized by the government for the reason that you said, people are going to show up that are really sick, and that's exactly who we're trying to help.
How many people have signed up? I haven't heard about this plan, not that I'm an expert in these matters, but I try and keep up with things.
Well, we've got just a bit, I think, over 2,500 now in California, and we'd certainly like to see a lot more than that. Actually, I'm looking at my numbers here. I'm seeing 2,600, but it's coming. It's picking up quite a bit faster. A lot of people have come in because the insurers have been working with us and telling people who they've denied, hey, there's this program for you. We're trying to get to more insurance brokers so that there may be people out there that are handling somebody's life and automobile and home insurance and knows maybe that they need, you know, medical insurance and have not been able to get it for them. So as I said, we're talking to everybody who will sit still and listen to this story.
Now, as you said, effective 2014, insurers will not be able to deny people because of pre-existing conditions. Does that mean that they won't be able to bring about any changes in their coverage. Basically, it just does not matter, effective 2014, whether you have leukemia or anything.
Right. I mean, what's envisioned in the health law is spreading the risk of disease over that broader population, so that everyone shares in the cost of taking care of the health of all of us, basically.
The governors of some states were opposed to the federal health care overhaul, and they have declined to participate in some parts of it. Has that been the case with this, too?
Right. About half the states. It's not that they declined to participate, but they decided not to stand up their own programs. And again, as I said, in those states, Nevada is one of those states. We have a federal program for the people in Nevada.
If someone has a pre-existing condition and they're not insured because they've been denied or they can't afford the insurance they've been offered, what should they do today regarding PSIP, the pre-existing condition insurance plan?
They pick up the telephone and call 877-428-5060, or they go to PCIP.ca.gov, and they can get an application and sign up for this program. They will have to produce something that demonstrates that they were denied insurance, or that they were, you know, presented with an unaffordable premium, one greater than these premiums.
Finally, David, since you're with us on the phone, are you able to comment on the effort by some in Congress to change Medicare to a voucher program? Because, you know, you're the regional administrator of the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in a big part of the United States.
Well, I guess what I can say about it is there's no complete, you know, health reform. I've been doing this for over 30 years, and I've lived through a lot of big pieces of legislation that changed this program. And there are always opportunities to improve and change things, and there are always different ideas about how to do things. And so what we do at CMS is try to execute the program that exists today in the best and most efficient possible way, because that is our job, and we don't have a political role. And so we don't, you know, formally comment on different proposals, but what I would say about it is all of the people that are our elected officials are serious about their commitment to our country and their ideas about what should be done. And what listeners need to do is really pay attention to what different people are proposing and, you know, open their mind to listen to it, because it's only when you listen and begin to understand the different approaches that you can fashion your own, you know, thought about where it should go. And so, you know, fundamentally, our program has a fee-for-service component. That's about 75% of the people in the program, and about 25% of the program are in something called Medicare Advantage, which is a version of Medicare where you receive your insurance from private insurers. And I think a large part of what's under discussion now, and has always been a point of discussion, is to what extent should we have a federal program with, you know, direct federal assumption of the risk for the program, or should the program more be operated by private carriers, and as our prescription drug program is now. And for us at CMS, we've been running both kinds of programs for a long time, and if the Congress or the President makes some future changes in the program, we're going to do our best to make those successful. As of today, what's in the Affordable Care Act, most of that hasn't happened yet. There's a lot of things in the law that we're just beginning to implement today. We're confident that many of those things are going to make our program stronger. They're going to make it more cost-effective. They're going to provide for better health of the population that we're serving, and actually a salutary effect for everyone. Whatever future changes come, we'll be ready to embrace those as well.
David Sein is Regional Administrator of the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Region 9, based in San Francisco, and his jurisdiction includes California, Arizona, Nevada, Hawaii, and the Pacific Trust Territories. And we've been talking mainly today about the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan, or PSIP, which is spelled PCIP. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll talk about how you can be more connected to the food you eat. It's Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, a conversation about math and the brain. Also, 50 years ago, President Kennedy launched America's effort to land a man on the moon. Are similar-sized projects still an option? Science Friday starts at 11. When we were hunter-gatherers, we were intimately connected with our food. We knew exactly what it was, where it came from, and what it took to kill it. Now that we get most of our food from shops and restaurants, eating is more clinical. But Sacramento food writer Hank Shaw wants to help change that. He's author of the award-winning blog Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook. And now Hank's written a book about catching, harvesting, and preparing your own food. It's called Hunt, Gather, Cook. I asked Hank if there's one part of that, the hunting, the gathering, or the cooking that he prefers.
It really depends on the time of year. I mean, everything goes to its season, you know. I guess they said that in the Bible. But fall and winter, I am almost exclusively in the duck blind, or I'm out, you know, chasing God's creatures. And then, you know, from really about once the weather starts to warm until Labor Day, I'm on the water all the time. And then kind of foraging fits in with all of that. You know, I don't think there's any particular time where I'm not hunting or fishing, but I'm always foraging.
You're always foraging. And what about the cooking part? That's one third of it.
The cooking part is every night. I just was at a restaurant downtown maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it occurred to me, like, wow, I really don't get out anymore. I'm cooking at home so much.
You were a political reporter for 19 years. How does a guy who covers the state capitol get into being a food writer?
Well, for years and years, when I was doing politics for a living, food would keep me sane. I mean, you know, you've been down to the Capitol.
Yes.
And it just, politics just seemed to get a little bit worse and a little bit worse, a little harder to deal with, a little less compromise year after year after year. And it became something that I was good at, but I didn't love anymore. Mm. And food just started to take a bigger and bigger piece of my life. And then finally, a year ago, I cut the umbilical and went out on my own.
So food kept you sane when you were writing about politics. Does politics keep you sane now that you write about food?
It's starting to. For a full year, I was in a complete denial. Yes, I did vote in the last election, but I was just a regular voter for the first time in my entire life, and it felt kind of good.
Had you always been into hunting and fishing and trying out food that's off the beaten path?
I've always been, the last part is very true, but I did not start hunting until I was 30 years old. I didn't start until I moved to Minnesota, but I had been a forager and an angler my entire life. I mean, my mom taught me to fish when I was maybe 4 or 5, and we used to spend our summers on Block Island, which is, it's an island next to Nantucket off of Rhode Island, and we would spend all kinds of time picking blueberries and wild onions and digging clams. And that island's really a paradise for a young kid. And it's almost entirely edible. And that's, I think that gave me the bug at a very young age.
My guest is Hank Shaw. He's a food writer, and his new book is titled Hunt, Gather, Cook, Finding the Forgotten Feast. He's also author of the blog Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook. What do you say to people who get grossed out at the thought of hunting? You know, they like to eat meat, but the thought of hunting, of actually killing that creature, is just too much.
It's a tough wall to cross, and I think I'm uniquely suited to help people cross it if they're so inclined, because I didn't start as a child. The first thing I ever hunted were rabbits and squirrels in Minnesota, and the first thing I ever shot was a gray squirrel in a walnut tree on a very, very cold morning in Minnesota, and my first thought was I was elated that I had actually successfully hit the thing. And so I ran over to the base of the tree, and there it was sitting in the snow. And it still didn't hit me until I picked it up, and it was warm. You know, I had fished for my whole life, and, you know, fish is cold. It's sort of, it's other. It's not us. Mammals and birds are closer to us, and that was kind of a hard, that was a kind of a hard mental space to occupy. But I've gotten through it in a sense that, well, that's what we do here. That's what everything does. Nature eats itself, and we're part of nature. And I would rather that squirrel live the life that God intended it to until it met me that day than to be raised, really, from the second it was born, to be raised as just a piece of food. And that helps people along with that process.
But what if you were out in the wilderness and a grizzly bear used the same argument regarding you?
That's one of the reasons why I don't like to hunt in grizzly territory, because it's, you know, it's fair game. I'm not going to go lightly into that night, but neither does anything that we go after. I mean, it's I don't view us as outside of nature. I view us as being particularly adept within it.
Are there any creatures when you've been out hunting that you almost shot or however you were hunting and thought, no, I just can't do it. That there's something about this creature. I can't kill it.
Well, in terms of legal game,
legal.
Well, I mean, it's legal to kill bobcats and coyotes, but I wouldn't hunt them because I don't want to eat them. That's where I draw the line at dogs and cats. Lots of people have different lines.
Bobcats and coyotes are a bit too similar to domesticated ones.
Exactly. And I've heard sort of sketchy things about people who do eat them that saying that they're not exactly the greatest eating in the world to begin with. So for me, that's where I draw my line.
Yeah. Now, what about foraging? What does that involve?
That's really one of the cooler parts about this book is that a lot of the people I end up talking with every day are either anglers or hunters, and a lot of them don't know much about foraging. But then a lot of the food people I talk to, they do foraging, but they don't know anything about angling or hunting. And foraging seems to be the link that brings both sides together. Everybody eats plants. And every ecosystem, there's not a single ecosystem in North America that does not have an entire suite of amazing edible plants. And I just got back from Pyramid Lake in the desert of Nevada, which is about as dry as you get. And there was stuff everywhere. You just have to kind of know what it is. And then that magic of knowing something's name. Back in the medieval times, they said that there was great power in knowing the name of something, and there is great power in being able to look at something in it. That's edible. That's what you do with it. And to share that power with other people, you can see their eyes light up immediately.
My guest is the food writer, Hank Shaw. Have you ever been foraging and saw a plant that looked interesting, looked edible, you didn't know what it was, but you took a chance anyway?
I've taken a chance with some plants because I know the families that they live in. There are certain families of plants. So it's basically, I know it's a cousin of something, right? And because I know, I make an educated guess. I won't do that with mushrooms because there's a number of mushrooms that, there's really only a few mushrooms that'll actually kill you dead, but there's a lot of mushrooms that'll make you sick. You've got to really know your stuff with them.
On your blog, I saw one recipe for a plant that a lot of people, I don't think they would eat, stinging nettle.
Scots? You should know about stinging nettle.
I do, but why why would you eat a stinging nettle?
Well, I mean, there are two real reasons. One is flavor and the other is nutrition. The reason why every culture in the world that has stinging nettles eats them is because they come out very early in the spring before many other plants come up. And they are absolutely loaded with nutrients. They are the green plant that, to my knowledge, is the highest level of protein in it than any other green plant in the world.
Really?
Something on the order of 20%. It's astonishing. And there's all kinds of other vitamins that are in it. So it's a tonic. I mean, if you've been eating dried things or roots or salt beef or salt pork your entire winter, when this green thing comes up in early March, it's a godsend. And yeah, it's stingy, but the stings go away once you boil it for a couple of minutes.
Yeah. Speaking of Scotland, you were going to bring me in a bannock.
I was.
But you didn't explain what a bannock is.
A bannock is it's a Scottish sort of flattish bread made. I make them with barley. I mean, I've seen them made with oats as well. Mm. And it's a griddle bread. It's an easy bread that you can make right on the stovetop. And it's fantastic eaten with just with some butter. But it's one of those breads that you got to make and eat. And the reason I didn't bring you one, Jeffrey, is because it would have been cold by the time you got it.
Oh, yeah, that just wouldn't be the same. But you've been experimenting with other grains as well for mm-hmm. breads and so on?
The subtitle of the book is called Finding the Forgotten Feast. And one of the things that all of us, everybody in North America and really in the world, used to do is we used to eat all of these things that we don't really eat that much anymore. You know, barley, rye, amaranth. I mean, obviously, in Scotland, you wouldn't eat amaranth, but in Southwest United States, you'd eat amaranth. I mean, it's sort of these alternate grains that used to be what defined us as who we were. And now all we eat is wheat. We eat corn. We eat pork. We eat beef. Maybe we eat salmon. We eat chicken. I mean, there's so much else that's out there that it just, it seems a crime to ignore it.
Hank Shaw's book is titled Hunt, Gather, Cook, Finding the Forgotten Feast. Also in your website, you talk about your garden, My Wild Garden, it says. And you say that this year, instead of cabbages and tomatoes and melons, you'll be growing orach and yampa and ramps.
Yep.
What are they?
Orach is a friend of lamb's quarters, and they're both friends of spinach. They're all in the same general family tree. It's essentially a wild spinach. And yampa is it's in the parsley family, and it looks a little bit like actually it looks a little bit like hemlock. But you eat the roots of it. And I'm sorry, what was the third one? Yampa. Oh, ramps. Ramps are wild onions. Ramps are sort of the most famous wild onion, but they don't live here in California. We have our own wild onion called a three-cornered leek that I just found a really big patch of right outside of Folsom yesterday. But the point is, wild foods nowhere, they're tougher. They grow easier. They are often harder to start from seed, but once they're there, they're much more hardy than a plant that we have coddled for millennia in some cases. And they become weakened. And I kind of like the idea of a strong, self-sustaining garden.
And what about duck fat hollandaise that you also...
I should have brought you some duck fat hollandaise.
I've written about. obviously, it's a different basic ingredient than regular hollandaise. How can that be good for you, duck fat?
Funny you should ask. Of all of the animal fats, bar none, the animal fat that is the best for you in terms of health is duck fat. When you render duck fat, especially wild duck fat, when you render out, you know, basically you simmer it in a little water and then it sort of cooks in its own fat. And then all the solids will cook away and make cracklings, which you can then eat. And then you're left with a liquid fat that's very clear. It will stay at room temperature. No other animal fat that I know of will be liquid at room temperature than duck fat. It's extremely low in saturated fat, much lower than butter, even lower than lard. And lard is actually better for you than butter. I mean, it's not olive oil, but I mean, it's a way to actually extend every duck that we shoot in season. We make use of pretty much everything but the quack.
When people come around to visit you, Hank, at home, do you get some people who go, Hank, tell me really what this is that I'm eating?
They know better. They ask me afterwards because they trust me because, I mean, I've been cooking for so many years. They trust that whenever I put something in front of them, it's going to taste good. So they always eat first, and then they ask me that question. Like, what did I just eat?
And is there anything that you just, that even you have not cooked because it just grossed you out, the thought of it?
Yeah, there's a few things. I'm not a huge fan of, there's a guy named Chris Cosentino who runs a restaurant called Encanto in San Francisco, and he seems to always be able to one-up me. He will take the intestines out of a goose, clean them out, and cook them like you would eat tripe. That's a bit much for me.
Yeah.
Would I do it on a dare? Sure, but I'm not going to do it on a daily basis. And, you know, I'm kind of not a big fan of eating brains either.
Yeah.
I don't like the texture.
Finally, Hank, what's the secret to what you did? You had a regular job as a journalist for 19 years, and then you became a food writer, and your blog has done really well, twice nominated for a James Beard Award. You got your book coming out, a book tour. How did that all happen?
Fortune favors the bold. I mean, sort of mechanically, the first thing I did is I got myself out of debt. And if you get yourself out of debt, all things are possible because you are then able to live on much less money while you are trying to make your own way. And without that, I would never have been able to do it. I work with Elise Bauer at Simply Recipes. She lives here in Carmichael. She's got one of the most successful food blogs in the world. And I help her out a couple times a week, and that, you know, that provides some income. It's all sort of by hook or by crook. So far, it's working.
Did you guess that it would lead to this?
I hoped that it would lead to this. I wasn't. You can never really be sure about anything. And you know, I still like politics. I still keep up with it. And if this were all to go south, I'll be back at the Capitol.
Yeah, there are a few things going on there.
But some things never change.
Yeah. Hank Shaw, food writer. His new book is titled Hunt, Gather, Cook, Finding the Forgotten Feast. He's also author of the award-winning blog Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook. Hank, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, an acclaimed new play about Anne Frank is getting its world premiere in Sacramento. It's Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's no Insight on Monday because of Memorial Day. We're back on Tuesday. Topics will include the new plan for an arena in downtown Sacramento. A new play about Anne Frank is getting great reviews. It's based on the famous diary by the German Jewish girl who hid from the Nazis. The play's called Extraordinary Things, and it's the author's first produced piece. She's actress Dana Friedman, and she's been in many plays at Sacramento's B Street Theater. We'll talk with her and the director who commissioned the play in a minute. But first, here's an excerpt from the B Street production of Extraordinary Things. It's when the Frank family arrives in the attic.
Now, we're going to put our shoes in this basket.
But this is just above your office.
Yes.
I didn't even know this space was up here.
No one does.
Well, won't people know? It can't be safe.
We've arranged it all.
This will be the first place anyone thinks to look.
It's safe. As safe as we can hope for. No one knows we're here.
No one knows?
Well, except, of course, for the people who will be helping us. Me, and Ellie, and Mr. Crayley, and Mr. Kufis from the business. And, of course, the Vandons.
When will they arrive?
Well, they'll be here in a week. But there are still many things we need to do. Unpack the boxes, fill the cupboards, lots of tidying up to be done. So we should get started right away, all right?
All right.
Playwright Dana Friedman is in New York City. She's on the phone with us. Dana, thanks for joining us in Insight.
Hi, my pleasure. Thank you, Jeffrey.
How did this come about? How did your first produced play come to be the story of Anne Frank?
It was sort of a joint decision, I think, between myself and Buck Busfield. The idea was introduced that I might write something for the family series for B Street, and there was a long list of potential titles or titles to be worked with, and this one stood out, sort of actually to both of us. It was kind of immediately the thing.
Had you read?
Felt important. Sorry, go ahead.
Had you read Anne Frank's diary before you worked on the play?
Yes, I had many years ago. I think, like most children, maybe around 11 or so was the first time that I had any exposure to it. I knew about it before that, but that was the first time I had read it. But then, you know, going back after all these years and rereading it, it was a very different experience.
In what way?
Not that. I started to say there are some things that maybe I didn't understand then, but I don't think that's true. I think that there are some things that maybe I understood in a different way then, and that that I needed to be reminded of again. It's filled with the diaries, just filled with sort of incredible insight in the way that. Only a new mind can have for the first time. It's filled with all these firsts. And it's amazing to go back and read that and just, again, you, for the first time, experiencing.
I'm talking with Dana Friedman, playwright. Her play Extraordinary Things about Anne Frank is running at the B Street Theater in Sacramento. This is its world premiere run. In our studio is Buck Busfield, who's co-founder of the B Street Theater, producing director, and he encouraged Dana to write the play. Buck, welcome back.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Thank you. Happy to be here.
What was on your mind when you put together Dana and this extraordinary story?
Well... Dana's a wonderful writer. We've seen her writing before at the B Street Theater in monologues and in short little one-acts and some stuff that hasn't been seen that I've read. So she's a great writer. And as she just said, we were looking for titles, and we always try to find a nice variety of different titles in each season. So we'll do a funny one, a silly one, a serious one. And so we thought for a serious one, Anne Frank would be the perfect story. And also it's a story that just can never stop being told. So we had the writer and we had the story.
And why is it called Extraordinary Things as opposed to The Diary of Anne Frank?
Yeah, I think that Dana is much more familiar with the text, but actually Anne Frank uses that expression. But really what it is that this young girl, this woman, young, very young woman, adolescent, is able to see the world in an extraordinary way, an extraordinarily mature way, considering what's going on around her.
Dana, do you have anything to add to that?
That's it, exactly. It's just, yes, the direct line from the diary, I think, is extraordinary things can happen to people when they go into hiding. But really, the greater, those two words, extraordinary things, I mean, look, she's faced with everything terrible. Anything you can possibly imagine and more basically happens to this young girl by the time she's 15.
Yes.
And yet she has a light. She just is somehow filled with joy, and not because it comes easily to her. It's just, like Buck said, it's her way of seeing things. It's something gifted.
It's a very sensitive story, of course. The subject matter is very sensitive. Did you have to get special permission to adapt the story for the stage?
Yes, and Buck, do you want to take this one?
Well, yeah. Thank you, Dana. The Anne Frank Fonds, the foundation in Switzerland, holds the licenses. They issue the licenses for any dramatic adaptation of the diaries. So they were very helpful, and they didn't seem to have a problem at all. Yeah.
Do they impose any conditions?
No.
Wow.
Amazing, right?
It's amazing because they're traditionally very protective of that. And we'll be able to do it again and again. So we're happy. Yeah.
We're talking about Extraordinary Things. It's a play about Anne Frank at Sacramento's B Street Theater. It's part of their family series. Dana Friedman is the playwright. Dana, you've been in many plays at the B Street Theater, but under your stage name, not your playwright name. Your stage name is?
Dana Brooke. Yes, that's my full name officially is Dana Brooke Friedman. So,
why use your real name for being a playwright as opposed to being an actress?
Because there's no playwrights union that says that you can't have two of you. So when I joined the actors union, Dana Friedman existed. So I could have been Dana Brooke Friedman, but it's a mouthful. So I just went with the middle name.
Well, you're very used to reading other people's words on stage. Now you're watching other people read your words on stage. What do you prefer?
Oh, you're going to make me choose? Can't I just say I actually love hearing it? I've really, really enjoyed this process. Like you said in the introduction, this was my first full production. And Buck, you know, I was fortunate enough, he brought me out there for a lot of rehearsal to do rewrites and just to listen to it. And what a wonderful thing. I had a blast, and it's pretty magical.
Well, yeah. maybe Dana Brooke prefers acting and Dana Friedman prefers writing. That might be one way of looking at it.
I think that's the perfect answer, one I could have saved a lot of time with. Thank you. I'll use it from now on.
Buck, this is part of the family series. Does that mean it's intended for children?
Yeah, it is. It's for 10. We think this one, we try to target each show to a different age group. This is probably for 8 and older because of the more mature themes.
And it's a relatively big production. You have, as I understand, 7 equity actors in it?
Yeah, you know, when people hear children's theater, the first thing they think is that children are performing. No, these are all adult professional actors. And this is a big one for us. We have 7, we have 9 players on stage, 7 are union. That's probably bigger than most union shows anyone's seen in town this year. Yeah.
And it's already open. It's getting great reviews. How long does it run for?
It's going to run through June 5th. And now it runs weekends only for the general public, but we do 12 performances a week. So we do an additional 8 performances a week for schools, field trips. They come visit us Tuesday through Friday. Most people don't know about that, but Saturday and Sunday for the general public. We'd love to have as many people come see it. It's a great production. It's, you know what it is? We call it Broadway quality theater for kids. That's what it is. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like a lot of opportunities to see it. Dana, are you going to be coming back out one more time?
I hope so. Ask a big man.
That's a yes.
That's a yes.
Oh, well, good.
Well, thanks so much. We've been talking about extraordinary things. It's a new play getting its world premiere run. It's about Anne Frank. It's running at Sacramento's B Street Theater, part of the Family series. Dana Friedman is the author. She's also an actress. And Buck Busfield is a director and co-founder and producing director of the B Street Theater. Thank you both for joining us.
It's our pleasure. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, the 30th annual Sacramento Jazz Festival. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. One of Sacramento's longest-running signature events starts in a couple of hours. It's the 38th annual Sacramento Jazz Festival and Jubilee. It started out as a Dixieland event, but now also includes blues, zydeco, Latin, and other kinds of music. This year, the festival has a new director. He's Greg Willett of the Sacramento Traditional Jazz Society. I talked with Greg about the festival's evolving name. It used to be the Jazz Jubilee. Now it's the Festival and Jubilee. Is he getting close to dropping the word Jubilee?
I'll say yes and no. A couple years ago, we actually did drop Jubilee. For 1 year, it was the Sacramento Jazz Festival, and it caused a lot of confusion in the marketplace, especially from our core audience that's been coming for 38 years now. So we put Jubilee back in. I could foresee a time when it's the Sacramento Music Festival or the Sacramento Jazz Festival just by itself.
And what's the difference?
Well, music festival obviously would encompass even more styles than we offer now.
Are you planning to add more styles of music?
We do it by committee at the end of each festival. We analyze what worked the best, and so the answer would be, yeah, we probably will, even at the end of this festival, take a look at what sounds worked and what sounds we might want to introduce for the following year.
Can you give us some examples of what you might add or take out?
I don't know if we would take out. I think we might add. There's been a lot of conversation. People have asked, how come we don't have maybe a bluegrass band or some representation from the bluegrass sound? Yeah. That might be an opportunity for us. It's becoming more and more of an Americana celebration of music. So we have a little of everything there, just about.
Yeah, I mean, you say you might add other kinds of music, but there is quite a variety of music as it is. I mean, it started with traditional jazz, but you get zydeco and R&B and Latin jazz and so on. What's your personal interest? What brought you into this field in the first place?
I happen to play piano myself, and I think I was 11 or 12 years old the first time I came to the jazz festival. And literally used to ride my bike down from my parents' house and spend all day and listen to the music. And so that really made me into a musician. But I really do passionately love all styles of jazz, and that's any improvised music.
Yeah. And what about you, Jim Casale?
Well, I'm a lifetime Sacramento in and musician, play drums. I've played at the Jazz Festival. Never played drums at the Jazz Festival. I've played twice in my lifetime, and both times I played washboard in a jug band, of all things.
Yeah.
And I met Greg when we both worked here at a television station in town, and he asked me to give him a hand this year, and it's been a great ride.
We're talking about the Sacramento Jazz Festival and Jubilee. This Memorial Day weekend runs through Monday. And Greg Willett, this year's emperor Tom Rigney.
Yes.
Why is there an emperor? Who is...
I don't know if I could give you the exact history as to how we came about originally having an emperor, but every year we try to choose somebody, either a musician or somebody from the community that embodies the spirit of the Jazz Festival and Jubilee.
What's the role of the emperor?
Kind of to represent the event throughout the course of the year. Tom Rigney, we've had several traditional jazz style emperors over the years, and Tom, as you probably know, doesn't come from the traditional jazz world. He's a fine violinist and has more of a kind of a Cajun sound to what he does, and he's a well-known instrumentalist that plays throughout the country, so he represents the event for throughout the rest of the year.
And how do you think he'll go down with longtime Jubilee fans who are more into the traditional jazz?
Well, he's been on our stage several years, and he's a crowd favorite without question.
Greg, this is your first year as the boss.
It is.
What were you doing before that?
I actually worked for the Jazz Society. We have a pretty lean and mean staff, but I was the development director there, working on business relationships, sponsorships, that type of thing. And I kind of fell into the role of executive director.
And you've been involved as a volunteer before then?
For about eight years, yeah. I worked on the publicity and advertising committee.
Well, what's it like when you actually take over the reins? It's a big project.
It's we have 2,200 plus volunteers. So the hardest part of my job is reining in all of 2,000 plus volunteers for our event.
2,000 plus volunteers?
Yeah,
what do they all do?
We have upwards of 100 plus managers. There's a sound crew. There's an important beer crew. You know, who gets the beer from spot to spot. We have a massive construction crew. It takes them all of a week to build the entire event. So there, some of the folks actually are volunteers. Longtime volunteers come from around the country, and they make this their vacation week. They'll come out and they'll bring their RV and build the stages and build the sites for us, and then enjoy the shows for 4 days, and then tear it all down.
Jim, the Jazz Jubilee, as it was known, used to be much more spread out over Sacramento. There was a big part of it was at Cal Expo, and it's much more focused now on downtown Sacramento, in particular Old Sacramento. Is it better that it's more focused in one place, or did you prefer it maybe when it was more spread out in a bigger area?
I like the consolidated aspect of it. It's basically all pretty much in one place. There are about four venues outside of Old Sac, but everything being so close, you can get from venue to venue quite easily. You can, whatever kind of music you want to hear, you're in walking distance to it. So that's a big plus.
Greg, do you hear from people saying Cal Expo was just more convenient?
We used to have a lot of folks that came from around the country in their RVs, and Cal Expo has a great RV a lot where people can park, and then they could just walk to the venues there. So
not so much space in Old Sac for that.
Exactly. So we hear from those folks. We wish that we did have accommodations for RV parking, but I'm very much in agreement with Jim. I like the charm of Old Town is what lends.
Yeah, I mean, if you squint your eyes, Old Sac could look in a certain light. Look a little bit like Louisiana.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. What are you most excited about in this year's Jazz Festival? Is there an artist or something happening this year that you're going, wow, I really can't wait to see that or hear that?
For me, it's the diversification of bands. Every year we do, we add new acts to maybe that haven't been here before. And then we also bring some returning acts as well. But nothing, for me, it's really the overall event since as in this role as executive director. I'm more worried about everyone having something to choose from when they get down there.
Sure. Well, understandable that you want to be nonpartisan in that. What about you, Jim? Do you have something you're particularly looking forward to?
Yeah, I think one of the newer aspects of the festival is that on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, we're calling them party nights and looking to attract the younger crowd. On Friday night, we have the Santana tribute band playing, the Rhythm Vandals. We have Mick Martin playing. We have a local band called Steelin' Dan that does the music of Steely Dan. And those shows start at 10 o'clock.
So those are separate from the main festival?
Those are separate, but if you buy a day pass or a four-day pass, you'll be able to get in at no extra charge for that.
Well, speaking of Mick Martin, he's also Professor Mick Martin. He's taught many things over the years, but he's teaching jazz and blues.
He is. We actually have a great partnership with the folks at Drexel University, and
happens to be right next to Old Sac.
It does. It's immediately contiguous to Old Town. But we went to them and asked if they would like to help us out as a sponsor. They said, "Well, we are an academic. We're part of an academic environment." So we put our heads together and came up with the Drexel Masterclass series. And Mick this year is doing a lecture. Over the weekend on the kind of the relationship of jazz and blues.
So the Jazz Festival, Sacramento Jazz Festival and Jubilee starts at 11:45 and runs through Monday, Memorial Day weekend, most of it in Old Sacramento, but there's some other spots in downtown Sacramento. Greg Willett is executive director of the Sacramento Traditional Jazz Society, which runs the festival, and Jim Caselli does marketing. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Appreciate it.
Well, that's Insight for today and for this week. We're off on Monday because of Memorial Day. We're back on Tuesday. Our theme is composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers, Liz Cazares and Christine Guerra. By the way, this was Christine's last week with Insight. She's moving on to a new assignment in Indianapolis. She's done some great work here on Insight. We really appreciate all that she did, which included editing our Hank Shaw interview today. Christine, thanks again and best wishes. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Have a great and safe weekend.